Welcome to COVID Island Dramas, a variation on a well-known theme. I'm Jack Claff, and we're asking guests to tell us which 8 radio dramas they would take away with them whilst isolating on their own COVID island. And in time-honored tradition, they can also take a couple of other things, a single piece of music, and their most cherished moment of the COVID lockdown. This week, we're talking to Nigel Deacon. Nigel Deacon is a chemist, apple breeder, pianist, and collector. He runs the website Diversity, also known as Sutton Elms. And let's get some figures, Nigel. What is in the collection just of the radio dramas that you have in your home?
Well, probably around 20,000 items, and probably half of those I've recorded myself.
Okay. Very often you had to record them while you weren't there, while you were at work and so on.
Oh yes, but it's not difficult. You just have to want to do it.
And let's get down and dirty. You do not possess a television.
No, I don't have a television. I find radio is more thoughtful. Radio drama does seem to attract very, very talented people, and that they have great ways of presenting what their thoughts are via the medium of drama. Big talent, small ego.
Okay. So tell us about how it all began.
When I was young, I suffered from severe hay fever, and this meant I was stuck indoors for most of the summer, and there wasn't very much else I could do apart from listen to the radio because my eyes were very sore. I used to listen to Test Match Special, comedies, and a few plays, and Round the Horn was a real favourite. I was put onto this by the head teacher of my primary school, Mr. Muncaster, and he loved wordplay and poetry and funny stories.
All right, let's dive straight in, Nigel, and tell us about your first radio drama clip.
Well, this first clip is by Giles Cooper, and it's entitled Under the Loofah Tree, and it's about a man locked in his bathroom. He's sitting in the bath, and people keep interrupting him, and he won't let them in.
We should say, since we're celebrating the medium, that Giles Cooper represents the gold standard of radio writing.
Yes, it does. And another thing which represents the gold standard is the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, and they produce the remarkable sound effects.
Leg. Other leg. All right so far. Warm, but not agony. Bend the knees. No, no, I can stand it. Sit. Lie.
Ted, don't take all the hot.
What?
All the hot. Don't take it.
Why?
When it's washing up, you never think.
Never think. Never do anything else but think. All the time thinking.
So you did pretty well at school?
Yes, I did okay. I was good at science, especially chemistry.
So you weren't really an arty type?
Not really, apart from the piano.
Okay. And how old were you when you started playing the piano?
Nine. I was obsessed with chemistry. I was absolutely fascinated with chemistry, and I found it very straightforward. And I thought it was a fascinating way of looking at the world, understanding the materials it was made of.
Right. You must have done really well at school, and then you popped along one day to Cambridge.
Yes, I went to St. Catherine's College for interview. Well, it was a bit strange, really. I didn't know what to expect because no one from the family had been to university before. So I went into this oak-panelled room and, I was a bit overwhelmed.
Yes, and a little old man, apparently.
Well, that's right. He looked a little bit tatty. He was in his 60s and a well-worn suit, well, a very well-worn suit, and he was standing next to the window and he was got a brush and he was sort of tidying up and sweeping stuff around. And he was obviously the caretaker. So I started chatting to him and asked him a few questions about the college. And there was a picture on the wall and I said, "Who's that?" And so he chatted back. And then after a few minutes, he put his brush down and said, "Okay, Nigel, I better interview you."
And in fact, by my understanding, he was quite an influence on you, not just in terms of chemistry, but in terms of life and indeed this whole journey towards being a collector of radio drama.
He was the archetypal Cambridge Don. He introduced his pupils not just to academic things, but to life and culture beyond a student's subject. And I learned about all sorts of things, Chinese porcelain, fine wine, much about music. And he let me use his piano, which was very kind.
Great. And so about the fine wine, you know, you become pretty much of an expert in another field as well, which is apples. Are you fond of cider, wine, beer, all that kind of thing? I mean, do you listen to a radio drama now late at night with a glass in front of you?
Quite frequently, yes. Fine wine is lovely. Sydney's speciality was Rhine wines, but I actually make my own wine now, and we have some great vines in the garden.
Let's go to the next clip, which actually has to do with big universities.
Well, it does. This is a piece called The Cleverest Man at Oxford, and it's by Geoffrey Parkinson. He worked for the probation service in London, and he took pride in the fact he'd never been promoted in over 30 years' service. He wrote for a little magazine which no longer exists called New Society, and he used the nickname Tail Gunner Parkinson, and he used to take pot shots at all and sundry when he disagreed with something or someone. Eventually, his line manager got so exasperated with this that he was banished to Woolwich, the Woolwich branch, which was as far away from headquarters as possible.
I'd never actually failed an examination at school, but that was merely because I'd never been considered sufficiently fit to actually take one.
We'd like Geoffrey to sit for his school certificate, Mr. Massing.
Well, examinations aren't the be-all and end-all of life, Mrs. Parkinson. Yes. Perhaps your son will prove to be good with his hands.
With his hands?
With his hands.
Regrettably, I not only failed to be any good with my hands, it soon transpired that every part of my anatomy seemed pretty useless from a commercial point of view. And so, as it became growingly apparent that I was incapable of helping myself, I decided I'd try to make a living helping others. As a social worker. Fortunately, at that time, I don't think the Department of Social Studies at Oxford could have been too exacting in its entry requirements.
Well, now... Yes. Now then, Mr. Parkinson, why exactly do you wish to undertake training in social work, eh?
I want to help others.
Others?
Yes.
Others? Yes.
Others? Hmm. With their problems?
Others with their problems, yes.
But what if you found that others hadn't got any problems, huh?
Ah. Ah. Or what about problems that somehow won't actually attach themselves to others, eh?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, you were working with your hands. Chemistry is quite a practical course, isn't it?
Chemistry is very practical, yes. It's theory is important, but it's essentially a practical occupation.
Yeah, you get your hands dirty, and believe organic is tough, or is the real tough
one. Well, it is. I remember one occasion I was doing an organic preparation, and I was warned about the inflammability of this stuff I was using, which was actually ether. And I was at the fume cupboard, and I just put a beaker of hot water into the fume cupboard, and I felt a sort of woof, and I felt my hair on fire. Setting the thing off just with a beaker of hot water, it was frightening. I had to go straight down the road to the barber and get it all sorted out.
But it didn't put you off alcohol?
Oh, no.
So we'll come to what you regard as important about chemistry, but I just want to do the plutonium event.
Oh, yes. Well, whenever I hear the cleverest man at Oxford and those dotty academics, it reminds me a little bit of my chemistry tutor, Alfie Maddock. He was very brainy, an excellent chemist, and he worked on the solution chemistry of plutonium. And there was an occasion when he held the entire UK stock of plutonium. This stuff was in a little glass bottle on his bench.
and priceless.
Absolutely priceless. It was the only sample, I think, in the UK, or virtually the only sample.
And so what happened?
Well, on this particular day, he picked it up to examine it, and he was a natural fidgeter, and he sort of played with it a little bit, and then he dropped it, and the glass broke. And the entire UK stock of plutonium soaked into the bench and disappeared.
Oh, my goodness me. So what happened then?
So he went down to the workshop in the basement and borrowed a saw, and then he went back to the lab and started sawing through the bench. And he sawed for a long time, eventually removed the piece containing the plutonium solution, and it leaving a large hole. And by this time, everyone had gone home. It was getting a bit late. He went back to the basement where there was a small furnace and placed the piece of wood inside. And then he turned on the furnace and set fire to the wood. And eventually he collected the ashes, went back to the lab and started work. He worked all through the night, and by morning, he'd recovered 90% of the plutonium.
That's such a great story, and it's a great tribute to initiative and lateral thinking and the best of science. But for you, what is it about chemistry? Why is it for you so valuable and important to science?
Well, it has revolutionized the way we live. To take a simple example, just imagine undergoing surgery or dentistry without anaesthetics. It must have been horrendous. In the 1920s, there was a tooth puller, as he was known, working in front of the Corn Exchange in Leicester Marketplace.
So it's not far from you?
It's about 8 miles away.
Right.
And
so you think about it as you go by.
Every time I go to the marketplace and see the steps up to the Corn Exchange, I shudder. There was a 3-man brass band, which the tooth puller used to have working with him. And when he was doing extractions, they would play very loudly so you wouldn't hear the shouting. It was a completely different world. Well, my next selection starts in a dentist's surgery, and it's by Stuart Parker. I won't say what the title is because that will spoil it somewhat, but it's important in a radio drama at the start of a play that you grab the listener's attention. And a dentist's surgery is a great way to do this because you can see everything without being told. So here we go.
Quiet as you can, please.
Ha ha.
Good. Mina, hand me what's the name? Thank you. Dear, oh dear, look at this. Swollen gums, nicotine stains, chipped edges. A right little den of iniquity, that's what we've got here.
Uh-huh.
I mean, hand me the pronged thingy. Now then, let's have a good probe. Yes. These teeth have certainly seen some heavy action. Not from a toothbrush either. Now, chewing gum, yes. And cigarettes, confectionery. Not to mention bean paste pickles for lunch. All right. Sorry. Cotton will mean a bit. Thank you. Yes, what I'll have to do on this little monster is a bit of a root canal procedure.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's no time for that today, I'm afraid. You'll need to come back in the morning. Still, there's a few quickies here that I can wrap up now. Nothing to worry about. All right. Just a bit wider, please. That's it. Good. Any other day, you see, I might stay on late. But I have a dinner engagement tonight. Actually, you might be more comfortable with an injection. Thanks. Yes, there's rather more to this little horror than I thought. That's it. Open one. Good. Good. All right, easy.
So, over the years, you've become acquainted with other people who, like you, do this kind of collecting thing. And so tell us a bit about the kind of people you found who do the same.
For many years, I thought I was the only person recording radio plays. And when I talked about them to other people, they just looked a bit blank. But one evening, I was sitting on my own in a pub, and a guy came in and he quoted a line from a Goon Show. And I couldn't resist, and I gave him the next line. And I can't remember what it was now, it's so long ago.
But out of the blue, he just, in the middle of a pub, he said something.
He falling in the water, or something like that.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And, well, I thought, well, there's an interesting chap. Anyway, after I gave him this line, he collected his pint and came over and sat with me, and we started chatting. And he was an observer lieutenant in the Observer Corps. and I told him about my radio recordings. And he told me something I didn't know, that there were lots of other collectors building up archives. And what's more, he told me how to get in touch with them. There was the Goon Show Preservation Society, and this led to other contacts that were interested in radio drama. So this was a revelation. It also meant that Alison had to become more tolerant because I got a lot more tapes than I had previously by exchanging.
All this time, you are teaching. You're a professional teacher. When do you have time to listen to programmes, and do you record them yourself while you're not by the set?
Oh, yes. If you want to record radio drama seriously and not to, if you don't want to miss all the good stuff, you have to set up a timer. You need a good radio, a timer, a recording machine, storage space, obviously, and you do need a tolerant partner.
Right. And you taught, as you said. Tell us about the school, because there were two rather famous pupils who were there as well.
Well, yes, I worked at what years ago was known as the Wiggiston Boys Grammar School, and I was in the chemistry department.
Dickie G and Uncle David.
Yeah.
Everyone's favourite national treasure.
Well, I remember when I first started, I was shown the accident book. It was 70 or 80 years old. And one of the early entries, it said, Attenborough, cut finger, blood everywhere. I don't know which of the Attenboroughs it was, but it was definitely one of them.
Definitely one of the two. And I think we should never know. So there's one other thing we have to mention, and that is that usually a chemistry master's called Stinks or Stinko. That's not the case, or is the case with you?
No, By accident, I found out what they called me. I didn't realise I'd got a nickname. But then one day a student came and asked me a question. And he said, Shaggy, what's the answer to... And I suddenly realised that he was talking about the character in Scooby-Doo, and that there was a resemblance at that time because I had a rather medieval haircut.
Oh, there was a resemblance. I mean, that passed. You don't look like Shaggy anymore. That's right. Okay, so, well, that brings us to another clip, and it is another work by Giles Cooper.
Yes, it is. It's a teaching play. There are lots of plays about teaching, and one of the best and best known is Unman, Wittering and Zygo. And I think this recording is from 1984. And this is about the experiences of a new teacher in a very forbidding school.
This is mine, is it?
All yours. I dare say there are a few of Pelham's things in the desk, but his heirs weren't gradual.
What did he die of?
An accident. Last week. He went for a walk, a sea mist came down, he went too near the edge of the cliff and fell over.
Oh, what a shocking business.
Or a merciful release.
Oh, he was ill?
No, just sick of lower 5B.
Are they really so awful? Now, I don't wish to crack the whip on our first morning together, but I will if you make me. I want no further interruptions.
But, sir...
Did you hear me?
Sir... Mr. Pelham said we were always to ask if we didn't know anything.
I do not care what Mr. Pelham said.
Oh,
now, look here! I know his death must have been a great shock to you, but life goes on and there is work to be done. We will get through this chapter this morning, or if not, we will do it this afternoon.
But, sir, it's a half holiday.
Yes, Terhugh.
And there's a second 11, man.
Yes, Haggeridge. Continue reading.
Oh... Many of the nobles were virtually little kings, raising their own armies and levying their own taxes. The authority of the crown...
Stop. Who's muttering?
Me, sir.
Unman, did you hear what I said?
Yes, sir.
He can't help it, sir.
He says hypotenuse, sir, all the time.
He likes the word.
Mr. Pelham said he was hypotenused by it.
Stop! Stop! Very well. You've had your warning. The form will stay in this afternoon from 2:30 until I am satisfied with your behaviour.
It's not a good idea, sir.
No, Cloisternoth. Tell me, why not?
Well, sir, Mr. Pelham did it once.
The week before last, sir.
And that was why we killed him.
All right, let's go from scary to lovely and tell us about... How you met your wife, how you met Alison.
Well, yes, I was friendly with a local teacher who wanted to be a professional singer, and she knew Alison, who I at that time I hadn't met. Alison was in a choir which sang madrigals. I went to a concert to listen, and it was absolutely magical. Alison looked so happy, and the music was out of this world.
You've been interested in music and been playing since you were about 9 or something?
That's right, yeah.
And she was there, up on stage?
Yes, that's right. But the madrigals, I've never heard anything like this. They were so bouncy and fun.
So you got to know each other?
Yes. She was a fan of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, so that was a good sign. She even had the books. And she's a good pianist as well. And we've been together ever since then.
And that's how long?
Well, 32 years, I think. Yeah, 32 years.
And this is probably the time just to talk a little bit about another, can we call it an obsession? You have this collection of radio dramas, but you also have an enormous collection of sheet music.
Well, that's right. I've got probably the biggest collection in the country of early music for keyboard. And that doesn't include stuff for 3 manuals. This is for 2 manual keyboard, piano, harpsichord, and so on.
And you go around the country getting this stuff in quaint little places.
Oh yes. When I'd exhausted that as a source, I used to get stuff off microfilm from the British Library and print that.
Wow.
I went through their entire collection and I printed all of it, all of the keyboard stuff.
Limey. And apparently you have an enthusiasm. William Baines?
Oh, William Baines, yes. We found a lot of William Baines's music on a trip to Batley. Many years ago, I had 2 friends I used to tour around with. We used to go to secondhand bookshops and music shops and house clearance shops. And there were 3 of us. There was Bernie, who was small and bent with an incredibly dirty Mac. He was one of my old teachers. There was Fred, who used to be a salesman. He was tall and straight with a tweed jacket. And there was me, much younger, with a black coat and a woolly hat. And Alison said we looked like Last of the Summer Wine.
Yeah, but other people were less flattering. And
Yes. We went to Beverly one time and went into a secondhand bookshop and we were sort of ferreting around. And I heard one of the assistants in the shop say to the other, "You'd better watch them. They look a bit dodgy."
Yes. Or shaggy, should we say shaggy? So, and then finally, you did manage to get some extraordinary works by this man, Baines.
Well, yes, we were quite sad, really, because Batley Library, they were throwing out an enormous amount of music, and a lot of it was by William Baines, who came from Huddersfield. It had never been borrowed in 50 years. Baines's music is out of this world. It's got hints of Chopin, Scriabine. It's incredibly difficult to play, but it's quite unique.
By which you mean you
can't
play?
Well, I can't. It's not really a music for the amateur. You have to be a dedicated professional and put in a significant amount of time to be able to master these things.
Right. There is a play about Baines, but you've spared us that one because you think it's too depressing, and you've chosen another clip that is about a composer.
Well, yeah. The clip I would like to hear is from a lovely play by Michael Robson called Jack's Back. And this is an entertaining comedy about J.S. Bach. And the maestro has just had a verbal punch-up with one of his musicians and has been banished to Hamburg. And when things have cooled down a little, he returns home. And there's a very nice scene where Bach interviews a trumpeter who wants to join his orchestra.
I have not had the opportunity of auditioning you for the post of principal trumpeter to the palace orchestra. Our patron, Prince Leopold, was, I understand, responsible for appointing you.
As to that, sir, though I am mortified that the name of Ned Nossiter of old London town is all unknown to you, and his fame unsung in High Germany, I am nevertheless prepared to play for you one piece, and one piece only. It runs 27 seconds by the clock. If after that you are unsatisfied as to my capability, I shall gladly refund my passage money to the court bursar and make my way to Stockholm, where artistes of my kidney are in singular and gratifying demand.
Then take up your instrument and blow, Herr Nossiter. But I warn you, if your performance does not live up to the lively expectations you have aroused in my breast, then the parting between us will be brief indeed. With what fragment will you transport us, Herr Nossiter, for 27 seconds by the clock?
A work for virtuoso trumpet by one of your own countrymen, sir. One Gottfried Reich.
Hmm.
believe that suffice, Mr. Bach. Or would you like it louder, faster, and funnier?
Herr Nossiter, I think you and I can do business together.
So, Nigel, you and Alison have been together for 32 years, and you've had an interest, certainly, in music. She's extremely busy. She works with computing. So tell us what happened in 2002.
Well, in that year, Alison was actually teaching computing, and she had to find out about how a website was constructed. So as a birthday gift, she made a website, a simple website for me, which she put online.
And this was a completely new thing for you? You hadn't thought of it before?
Well, it was. She gave me this website because she couldn't think of what to give me for my birthday. And I think it was a sort of act of desperation. You know, what can I get him? He's got everything else. Oh, I'll give him a website.
Yeah, and also computing and systems, there's storage. So maybe she doesn't have to have the house cluttered up. You could put it all in one device.
Well, yeah,
anyway,
possibly.
And so what happened then?
But anyway,
you started this thing in 2002.
Well, I didn't quite know what to do with the website to start with, but then I thought, what about trying to raise the profile of radio drama a little bit? So I wrote a few pages about radio plays by one or two well-known writers. Yeah, I got a big surprise. People started emailing me.
What sort of people?
Well, writers, producers, and people who loved radio plays.
Drop some names.
Well, Rodney Wingfield got in touch very early on, Catherine Chakowska. James Follett, who wrote Earth Search, Jerry Jones, who wrote that classic Time After Time, Wally K. Daly, who did Watts' Stigmata, and Richard Workley. In fact, Richard wrote a 15,000-word essay about his career and sent it to us. He was the most experienced radio drama producer in the country at that time. And Graham Gould got in touch, David Spencer, you name it. Everyone in radio drama seemed to be writing to me, and I was astonished. Since then, I've been contacted by literally hundreds of others.
And you had donations, and the collection's just grown and grown.
Well, it has, yes. Lots of these people didn't realise that the BBC disposed of most of the radio plays when they'd had their broadcast and two repeats. And they were appalled to learn that their plays were not in the BBC archive. The BBC isn't really an archive organisation. Other people, though, have made good that deficit, and many of the plays that writers thought were stored, I've actually been able to return them to the writer from private collections.
Do you have ones that are only recorded by you, you know, by Beckett and Pinter and those kind of people who went on to other things in other media? Do you have that kind of thing as well?
Well, yes, I do. Anthony Minghella, he started in radio and moved on and did lots of other things. One particular donation I had was quite astonishing. A person with an invalid mother who'd been confined to bed for 15 years, he wrote to me. She'd just died, but he'd recorded 6,000 radio plays and readings for her to listen to. And he said, would I like them? I mean, what a silly question. And I gave him a charity donation, and this external hard drive arrived in the post, and I'd got this magnificent collection of stuff, much of which I'd never seen before.
We have a question. How many of these have you yourself actually listened to, and how many of them have you actively liked, and are there many that you've disliked?
This particular collection, 6,000 plays in a single lump, I haven't listened to every one, but I've gradually worked through in a sort of random way. But with smaller donations of 40 or 50 tapes, I remember Micheline Wondor gave me everything that she'd ever written. I've listened to all of them. And there's not much point in having them otherwise.
Right. And have you liked the vast majority of them? Or have there been some real, real duds where you just lost your patience with them? Dish the dirt.
Well, not everything is a masterpiece, I have to say. And I don't necessarily like adaptations of stage plays. They don't always work. Some of the Shaw plays I don't like very much, but the vast majority, I just like to hear different people's experiences and different people's ways of trying to sort out the puzzle of life by writing about it.
So the next clip.
Yes, this is a lovely play where much of the action takes place on answering machines, cigarettes and chocolate, Anthony Minghella.
Hello, you've rung 341-6293. If you'd like to leave a message for Gemma, please do so after you hear the tone.
It's me. Listen, did I leave my new toothbrush with you? The one with the, it's got a, you know, The big head. I think it was in your bag for some reason. Don't brush your hair with it. And don't open the olive oil. I need something to give my sister.
Hi, it's me. Are we on for tonight? Will you ring me before we meet and remind me to bring my glasses, because I can't read the subtitles without them. Two reviews are in favour, one against. Ring at 6:45 and say glasses. Ta-ra.
It's Rob. I'm leaving home for the office, and I don't know what time I'll be home. Late, possibly, probably. Probably ridiculously late. Best thing would be to stay with you, otherwise I'll have to drive the extra 700 yards to my flat. Take pity on me.
Gemma, look, it's Alistair. You know, if you had anything from me this morning, you know, like a letter, don't read it. You know, if you haven't already opened, and if you have, don't think of it as a problem, you know, just think of it as a not very good poem.
Gemma? It's your mother. Are you there? If you're there and not answering, can you pick up the telephone? I suppose you're out. Could you please telephone when you get in?
Lots of very recognisable voices there. Nigel, we now move to apples. You've got land and you've got a lot of apple trees.
That's right. I moved out of teaching about 7 years ago. I wanted to have a go at doing something different whilst I was still young enough to make a job of it. And now I actually breed new varieties of apple.
And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as a result of the website, I got in touch with quite a few people in the apple trade, and one of them was an apple breeder. And he came over to England from South Africa, and he showed me how to cross one apple with another.
So, sorry. You just said, as a result of the website.
Yes.
As a result of the radio website, you got in touch with people to do with apples.
Well, yes, because there are other sections in the website that are sort of subsidiary, but they did attract some attention. I did some writing about apples because I collect rare apples, and I found quite a few people were interested in some of my finds. I found some red-fleshed apples, which when you slice them through, they're like a beetroot in the middle. They're really unusual. They look stunning. As a result of this, I got a visit from this apple breeder. He showed me how to do apple crosses. The upside for us now is I'm actually breeding apple varieties for a big nursery. And what I'm doing is I'm crossing red-fleshed apples with English apples to produce nice-flavoured, spectacular-looking fruit.
That's fantastic. So that's a wonderful image for us. That's the perfect image for us at International Art, because we're doing international radio plays, and you're doing grafting from all over the world to make a beautiful fruit. And you have a play that fits that?
Well, I do, because I'm very, very familiar with pulling out weeds from plots endlessly, hours and hours each week. And it struck me that in a radio play, anything can have a voice. Even dock plants, and I'm very familiar with dock plants. So here's a play by Don Howarth, and it's called On a Day in Summer in a Garden.
Nice morning.
Aye, grand. Nippy, though.
Morning mist and morning dew. Going to be hot today, young Jack?
Is it, Grandad?
Oh, when the sun strikes through on a hot day, early summer, there's no better thing in creation than to be a dock plant in this garden.
Because we fear nothing.
Correct.
What is there to fear, Uncle Jim?
Nothing.
Encroachment.
What's encroachment, Uncle Jim?
The other plants encroaching.
But we don't fear it.
Attempting to choke us.
Because we're more than equal.
Sometimes.
Always, Jim?
Not always, Dick. A large number of dock plants have been lost through the years.
You're here, I'm here, young Jack's here. This is our patch of the garden.
We've tried to teach them that.
Well, then, it's finally sunk in.
I don't think those daisies will come again.
What's daisies?
Surface leaf, white flower, close up at night. We throttled them.
Choke the life out.
And before that, the charlock.
And before that, the cornflower.
And before that, the hoary pepperwort.
Forget-me-not.
Nettle annual.
Bramble.
Wild turnip and shepherd's needle.
Pennycress and sow thistle.
The creeping buttercup.
Deadly nightshade.
And was the poppy before that?
And when was the groundsel?
And the tares. And the dandelions.
And the thistles and treacle mustard.
It's hard to remember which came in what year. We've choked them all in our time.
there's a feeling that radio drama is a kind of forgotten medium, but right now, radio is experiencing an incredible revival with podcasts, with dramas, with true stories, true crime, all sorts of discussions and so on. And it seems like it's a boom time. So how does it make you feel now? Gratified in some way?
Well, I'm very pleased at the prominence of radio drama at the moment. It seems to be becoming very popular. There are some super serials and very high quality work being done by independents. The BB Sounds website is being expanded. And radio drama is a fantastic way of finding out about social history. It's changed over the decades quite a lot. But the way people speak in a radio play written at the time tells you a lot about attitudes and the way that that society operates.
And your collection now, is it mainly digital? What's happening with new stuff that's coming in? What are you doing?
New stuff that's coming in, most of it is digital, but there are still quite a few people who contact me saying, I've got an old tape with this play on it. Can you digitize it for me? I've probably got about 2,000 tapes still to digitize, which isn't that many. But the vast majority of stuff that I'm collecting now is already in digital form.
Wow, 2,000, not that many. Okay. Now, if you were to be talking to an aspiring producer or writer or actor, anyone who's interested in radio drama, what would you say for you makes a radio drama special, important, worthwhile, powerful? What do you look for?
I look for a strong story. It doesn't have to be complicated. In fact, it's better if it isn't. You want a small number of characters so that they're instantly recognizable when they speak. It's got to resonate in some way.
So you've given us 8 clips. When you listen, do you listen alone, usually?
Usually I do, yes, because I do a lot of work outside in the orchard. And when I'm pruning apple trees, I have many hours sometimes of dull days and just snipping away. And it's nice to listen to plays then.
And do you find yourself moved in the sense, I mean, I saw you laughing. Do you laugh? Do you find yourself choking up or something? Because no one's watching, are you aware of the way you're reacting as you listen?
Sometimes I have tears running down my face and sometimes I laugh out loud. It's some of the plays I listen to are very moving, very, very powerful. And not just the classics either, but little plays that no one has heard of.
And they've surprised you, and you have had tears running down your face.
Many times, yes.
Your last clip.
My last clip is a very old one, and it's actually from a disc. This is a play from 1939. It's by D.G. Brideson, and it's called Aaron's Field. And it's about a man who's retired after many years of hard work. He's used his savings, and he's bought a field.
This is the BBC Home Service. We present Aaron's Field, a morality play for the eve of war by D.G. Brideson. The action takes place on September the 1st, 1939. Aaron's Field.
Under the shoulder of the fells that pile away to the blue north, where grass is golden and the bracken stains of rust as the ling puts forth, there where the trees are dark patches and fir woods flame with autumn birches, there where the river guides the dale and hawthorn shelters the grey stone walls, where grass is benty with nettle and thistle and lapwings wail and the curlews whistle, there in the valley of late life lies a field. Not very many acres are to it, and small profit comes from its run of grass and clover. But there where it rides the fell, perched on its edge and looking over the sweep of the river that hems the bottom, stands a cottage. 4 small windows dot the white of its wall before, and a narrow strip of garden lies behind the gate which guards the door. Each is a plea for standing still and thinking of work when the work ceases, and feeling the twilight gently fill the mellow hollows and empty places that come when life is nearly over. And there lives one whose work is over, a friendly man who looks for quiet, who smokes his pipe and loves his field and never thinks what acres yield. His nature and his lot the same, A man of peace. And Aaron is his name.
And now, Nigel, a piece of music, something resonant, something memorable, something that ties in, perhaps, could give you solace or some kind of good feeling during this COVID time.
I used to know a guy called Thomas Arnold Johnson until his death in 88. And he's well known for writing sight reading music, taking piano exams. For those who remember Billy Bunter, he also wrote the Greyfriars Suite for piano. At the time I knew Tom, he'd lost the manuscript. 24 years later, I found it, to my astonishment, on an American website dedicated to Charles Hamilton, who, of course, wrote the Bunter stories. I printed it off. It was very difficult to read, and Alison had to enhance it so I could actually read it. And I recorded it. This piece of music is called Quelchy, and you may remember that Horace Samuel Quelch was Bunter's form master, and the music, you can hear him whacking Bunter with the cane, and it's a very clever piece of writing.
And finally, Nigel, your COVID moment, just something from life.
During lockdown, there are lots of things we can't do normally. And at the moment, we can't buy any yeast for bread making. And Alison loves.
Tell me about it.
Oh, yeah, Alison loves bread making. And our COVID moment was when Alison baked our first really good sourdough loaf, which doesn't need any yeast.
Fantastic.
Nigel Deacon, thank you so much for giving us your COVID Island dramas.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
A sleepy lagoon, a tropical moon, and you on an island. A sleepy lagoon, and two hearts in tune, in some lullaby land.